It was me. Yeah.
All right. So we're going to discuss, well, we're going to start today our string theory course. So as you know, I'm Federico Cacciasso, and my office is 450 in the other building. And, well, needless to say, these are only 15 hours. And I learned today that it's really only 14. So I'm going to be in deep trouble because there is a holiday somewhere. Yeah, so there is a holiday next week. So we only have 14 hours. So it's going to be really a challenge to actually do something global that will give you a global impression of the string theory. But we will try nevertheless, okay? So, yeah, some people would say, oh no, how can we do that? Well, the way we're gonna do it is that, of course, you guys will have to work very hard. And second, at any point, I have to get feedback on what you know and what you don't know, what you have seen. It's very hard for me to follow everything that you have been doing up to now. Of course, the tutors will help me out. But I think it would be best if you guys are actually giving me a hand with that. And you tell me at every point if there is something that you don't understand, you haven't seen, something that I'm assuming that you know and you don't know. Okay? Very good. But let's start today. So today, I don't expect you to understand everything that I'm going to say today. Today is just more or less a motivation and why it would be interesting to follow this course and why we should study string theory. So the first question is, what is string theory? Okay. I also have another, even more ambitious plan for this course, which is to learn all your names. I'm not sure I'm going to succeed. But again, I'm going to try. Okay. So what do you guys know about string theory? What is string theory? Anybody?
Well, it's a theory of particle physics where instead of point particles, you have one-dimensional strings.
Excellent. So it's a theory of strings. That's what you would think, yeah? Anyone else? What else can it be, right? It's called a string theory, so it better be a theory of strings. Well, the truth is that it started as a theory of strings, okay? But it was later understood that this is only a small piece of the theory. So if we think about the whole theory, strings or the string description is only a small piece of it. There are other objects, which we now call D-brains. And perhaps there are even other objects that we don't know, okay? So I think it's fair to say that we have only started, even though we have spent a lot of effort, we have put a lot of effort in the theory, while we, as a scientific community, we only know a little bit of the theory, okay? So what is string theory, really, or the answer to that question, is still unknown. Okay? And that's why we need young, brilliant people to come and figure the answer to this question. Okay? Now, even though we cannot answer this question, there is something we can answer because it's history, and it is, how was string theory discovered? Any ideas? Well, that would have been a natural way to discover it, right? Say, well, we have theory of point particles, why don't we do strings? And then do the membranes, and then do other objects, right? But that was not the way it was discovered. Anybody knows the story? Excellent, very good. In the 60s, so what was the idea in the 60s. So how people were thinking about physics in the 60s, or what did they have at hand? Well, at that time, it was something interesting because people didn't really like massless particles, and there was a good reason for that. The only massless particles that was the only massless particle that was known at the time, what was it? Do you remember? It's the one that you know very well. What? Excellent. Yes. So the only one was the photon that was describing a U1 gauge theory, which is electromagnetism. Very good. And why didn't they like massless particles? Well, first of all, they only had one. And that was one compared to an infinite number, or what seems to be an infinite number of massless, massive, let's say, strongly interacting massive particles. Okay? By strongly interacting, I mean the strong force. So people were doing experiments at accelerators and discovering every day a new resonance, a new particle. So imagine the state of mind if you were in that situation, when every day you get a news, say, on the archive. Of course, the archive wasn't there, but imagine on the archive you say, oh, a new particle. Now it has a higher, we discover a new resonance with a high spin and this mass. Then, of course, what you will do is to start plotting, see if there is any relation between the masses and the spins of the particles you are discovering. And then people found that there was a relation between the spin and the mass of the particles. Now, what do I mean by a spin? Well, what is the Lorentz group in four dimensions? Yes, SO3,1. Well, that's what we call the homogeneous Lorentz group. If we talk about the full Lorentz group or the inhomogeneous Lorentz group or the Poincaré group, also known as the Poincaré group, we also have to introduce translations, right? Now, what are particles? What do we think about particles? What is a nice way to classify them? How do we think about these one particle states that we scatter, that we send and scatter and measure again? Well, we think about them, if we have Poincaré, we think about them as what do I mean by irreps? Irreducible representations. Well, maybe it doesn't have the other R. I don't know. Perhaps something like this. Ah. Well, let's write. Irreducible representations of Poincaré. Now, of course, we use as a Casimir. Do you know what a Casimir is? Well, you just have to find a generator that commutes with everything and some object in the group that commutes with everything. And P squared is one such object. So eigenvalues of P squared are good ways of classifying particles. And the eigenvalue of P squared is nothing but the mass square of the particle. Okay? So that's why the mass square is something interesting. Now, we also, in order to classify particles, we also use something that is called the Lyot group. Have you heard about the Lyot group? Yes? Well, some people say yes, some people say no. So the only logical explanation is that some people have heard about that, but not in this course. Is that fair to say? Well, imagine, it's not very difficult for a massive particle to imagine what the Lyot group is. Imagine that you are a massive particle. Since you're massive, you can study what happens when you are at rest, right? So you can put the particle at rest and see what is the subgroup of the Lorentz group that leaves that particle invariant. What do you think is a subgroup? Rotations, very good, excellent. So the Lyot group is SO3, and the representations of SO3 can be classified by something we call the spin of the particle. Okay? So the spin can only take half integer values, and thus this number that we have here. Now, people started to plot this and found that there was this linear relation, and they call the slope of these straight lines in the plot in m squared versus j alpha prime. So this was the slope. Okay, very good. Now, you're given this situation, and then you say, well, I want to build a theory that describes this. Well, you have, imagine you have quantum field theory, you know quantum field theory, and you want to start describing what happens when you have these particles. So imagine that you have the scattering, so you want to study scattering processes. Let me put this here. So your pictures. See if I can learn your names. Okay. So we want to study the scattering of these particles. Well, imagine that you have, I told you what the way you see all these particles, the higher the spin, actually the faster they decay. So you want to see, the only way you can see these particles are not stable. You don't see them everywhere, right? So the only way you can see these particles is as resonances. So you want to scatter some particle, a pair, some two particles, they produce a new particles as a resonance, okay, with some spin j, and you want to compute the contribution of all this to some scattering amplitude. I believe you have computed the scattering amplitudes before, right? Very good. So you want to compute the contribution of a given particle of a spin j to this. So what do you think should be this contribution? Well, certainly we need the propagator. Say this is particle 1, 2, 3, and 4. Okay? So in field theory, we call, imagine these are the particles that you're scattering, 1 and 2. So if the resonance is produced in this channel, we call this the S channel. Okay? Remember, S is P1 plus P2 squared. So if we have this particle in the S channel, the Feynman diagram that we draw is this one, and what we write is S minus M squared of the particle. Okay? If this was a scalar particle with a spin 0, we would just write a 1 here. Okay? But this is not a particle with a spin 0. It has spin j. So what do we do? Well, it turns out that when we see the scattering vertices with a particle with a spin j, the way to describe it is a particle with many indices. So when you try to write a cubic interaction, if you have a particle of many indices and say two particles here that you're scattering with a spin 0, say, okay? So how can you write something that is Lorentz invariant that has a vertex with two particles of spin 0 and one particle of spin j? Is there any natural way of writing a vertex that will do that? Imagine in the Lagrangian, you want something that has a field with many indices, with many Lorentz indices, as many as j, and then you have two scalar particles. How can you produce something that is Lorentz invariant out of that? Well, if you cannot come out with anything, then it would be great, because then it's impossible to couple these guys. Well, it wouldn't be that great, because we know the guys are there. Is there any other thing at hand that you use when you write down Lagrangians? You use particles. What else? You use the fields. What else do you put in the Lagrangians? Yeah, you could introduce other fields. That would be okay. But here we want just this coupling of the two scalar particles with this strange particle of high spin. So what are the ingredients in the Lagrangian? So we have fields, right? But we also act on the fields with derivatives, right? So we could also use derivatives. So if we have all these indices and we want to we want to eat them up so that we build a Lorentz invariant object, we have to put as many derivatives as the indices we have. So imagine we have this field that has j indices, and it's interacting with these two fields that don't have indices. So we have to put how many powers of derivatives? We have to put j derivatives. Is that clear? Well, imagine that we call the new particle, let's call it A, for the lack of a better name, and we have j indices, and this guy is coupling to two powers of this particle that is coming here, okay? And we want to make something that is Lorentz invariant, so we will have to put here j powers of derivatives with indices that will contract with these indices here, okay? Now, when you have an interaction vertex that has a derivative, what is the Feynman rule? Do you remember from QED? You probably did QED, some QED interactions, right? So QED must be an example, because there we have a particle with spin 1, right? So when you have a power of derivatives here, some power of derivatives here, what happens in the vertex? You get some momentum power there. How many are we going to get? Well, we're going to get j powers, right? But how many vertices we have here of this form? We have two vertices, okay? Now, it turns out that if you do everything correctly here, you get two powers of momentum to the jth, and two powers of momentum to the jth will give you a factor of this form, where t is a momentum transfer, okay? So that's what you get from this Feynman diagram. So this all looks great. So you have the term with, you have your infinite sum. Imagine that the number of, there was no reason to expect that this would stop, okay? People were seeing all these particles appearing with this correlation. So there was no reason to stop. So this scattering amplitude in the S channel would look like something like this. Okay? Perhaps there will be an infinite number of particles there. We don't know. Now, in principle, there is no problem with this. Okay? This looks great. Why would there be a problem? Well, we know that this is just, these kind of diagrams are just the first term in perturbation theory. We are supposed to put these diagrams in loops. Right? So whatever theory we have, we know that QED is very successful, and quantum electrodynamics is a full quantum field theory. And in order to reproduce spectacularly well things like G minus 2 of the electron, we have to compute many, many Feynman diagrams to high orders in perturbation theory. That's what tells us that the way we do quantum field theory is correct. Okay? So quantum field theory is definitely correct. So we have to do quantum field theory for these guys and see what happens. Well, if we try, we will get our particles, okay? And we will have to use Feynman diagrams of this form. Why would this be a problem? Well, let's just try to write down schematically what this object is. So there is some momentum running in the loop. Let's call it L. I'm not interested in the details of what this object is. All I want to do is to see what happens when the momentum is very, very large. Yes?
I'm not understanding something.
Yes?
If it's an S channel, does that mean time runs from
No, remember, Feynman diagrams are not meant to mean a history in time, right? Here, really what we are doing is integrating in coordinate space. We're integrating over all the positions of these points in coordinate space.
Okay, but what's going in and what's going out in that diagram?
Sorry?
What's going in and what's going out?
Very good. So we are scattering 1 and 2. Okay, the momentum, yeah. So maybe let me remove these guys here. Let me remove these labels here. So let's think about momentum 1 and 2, particles 1 and 2 coming in, and particles 3 and 4 coming out. OK? That's what we are scattering. So if you see the resonance in this channel, we say, well, these are the contributions in the S channel. OK?
Then I don't really understand why you're using a T in that equation, because the momentum transfer is a total momentum.
Yeah, this object that appears here, it so happens to be what appears from the contraction of the vertices when you do it carefully. OK? So that's what ends up appearing in the numerator. Moreover, another way of saying it is that if this was a power of s, then for a small s, you would get something that vanishes. And that's not what you see. You should expect to see a resonance. So you wouldn't expect that as you turn s down, your interaction, your cross-section would actually decrease. So that's why you see that here t should appear. You could ask, why not u? Right? Could it be u? Very good. I'll tell you why not u in a second. But for the moment, let's keep it there. So the question could be, your question could have been, why not u? OK. We will answer that in a second. But let's look first at what happens in this Feynman diagram when we have these interactions. Well, if you see, this looks like what we did there. This looks like what we did there as well. And we're just joining these two guys together. Okay? So what do we expect? Well, we expect that as a function of this momentum L, we're going to get something that behaves like this, only that two times. And we want to study this for large momentum. We want to see what happens at very, very large momentum. And why do we want to do that? Because we know very well that quantum field theories might be plagued with infinities, right? And the infinities we don't understand, the infinities we don't like, are infinities when the momentum is very, very large. Do you know how those are called? Those are called UV divergences. And what happens when the momentum is very, very small and you get a divergence? Infrared divergences. So people could start asking you, well, which ones are good and which ones are bad? Is there any good one? Are there? Well, we think we understand infrared divergences. When a theory has infrared divergences, we think we understand the physics of that, and we think we know how to control it. It's not a problem of the theory. Okay? But UV divergences, if they are too bad, it means that your theory is not meaningful. Okay? Or you don't really know what is going on at high energies, so your theory might not even make sense. So you will have to find an alternative theory, of which your theory is an effective theory. Okay? But let's see what happens in this case. Well, you have these two powers. So each one of these guys will go like L. So we have L to the 2j. Remember, we're looking at very, very high momentum. So m squared is irrelevant. We don't care about this power here. So we just have an L squared. Remember that s and t will go like L squared. But we have two such objects, so we have to put this square. Okay? So this goes like which for high enough spin give us trouble. Okay? What are the only UV divergences? Yes.
Why is that for one propagator we get that L to the power of the j when initially we had just t to the j?
Well, we got one copy of this here. And we got another copy of that here. That's all I'm doing. No, I get one of them. One of them is L squared to the j, right? And L squared in the denominator. Do you see any other problem? So this guy goes like L squared, gives me this contribution here, okay? L squared squared. So this square is coming from each of the two sides. So I have one here and one here. That's why I have two powers, okay? So for large enough J, we are going to have a problem. We have power divergences. Which are the only UV divergences that we like nowadays? Sorry? Excellent, logarithmic. So, but power divergences we don't like. So these are bad. Okay? Very good. So, let's go back to the question of why not U. It turns out that when you have particles interacting that carry some symmetry, some flavor symmetry, okay, it's useful to split the scattering amplitude. So these particles also carry some flavor index or some internal symmetry index. So it's useful to split. I don't think we're going to have much time to discuss that here, but it's useful to split the scattering amplitude in a form let me write it and then I'll tell you what it means. Where these are called, in modern terminology, color factors. And these are partial amplitudes made out of only Feynman diagrams that contain only channels, the channels that I've written here. Okay? So I don't expect you to understand this carefully. All it means is that there is a nice way of decomposing any amplitude as a sum of terms where the Feynman diagrams that you compute here only have exchanges in the S and the T channel. And here you only allow Feynman diagrams in the T and the U channel, and here in the U and the S channel. So what I've done here is drawn for you really what I call A of ST. Okay? So this is something that perhaps we will discuss later in more detail. But for the moment, this is not very important to understand what these factors are. Just it's important to know that there is such a decomposition and that these are the only symmetry factors that we want to include in the diagram. Now, do you know what crossing symmetry means? What it is?
Well, you basically have a Feynman diagram of, say, an annihilation and creation process, and then you kind of twist the diagram around and change some of the factors in the expression to make it a scattering diagram.
So what you're saying is that if you have a scattering amplitude of some momentum, so it's something that depends on some momentum. So let's say you are scattering P1, P2, producing P3 and P4. So your scattering amplitude, let's call it A, of P1, P2, P3, and P4. If you strip out momentum conservation, there is a delta function of momentum conservation, right? Because we are dealing with theories that are translation invariant. So in order to have translation invariance, we have to have, these are not supposed to be functions. These are supposed to be distributions. And it's a distribution because the scattering amplitude contains a delta function that imposes momentum conservation. Okay? Well, in this notation, it tells you that P1 plus P2 minus P3 minus P4 vanishes. Okay? But whatever comes here, here comes the assumption we believe is a beautiful analytic function of the momentum. Any reason to believe that? Well, not really, but we think it's true. Okay? So if this is a beautiful analytic function of momentum, why couldn't you just smoothly deform this momenta such that now particle P2 is outgoing and particle P3 is incoming. Nobody stops you from doing that, right? If this is a beautiful analytic function, you could do that. So pretend that you smoothly deform, analytically deform the momenta so that the momentum of this particle is now incoming and P2 is outgoing and P3 is incoming. Now, if you do that, the Feynman diagrams that you use to compute your amplitude, or you would think that that amplitude is an amplitude completely different, okay? So in principle, nature could have said, no, that's a completely different amplitude. You need a different computation to do the computation. And tough luck, yes, you have to work very hard every time you want to compute something. But nature is kind and tells us that we can use the same for all channels. Okay? So that's great. So that's what we mean by crossing. Okay? So we can use the same function for all channels. Now, what would that mean in terms of our scattering amplitudes there? Well, it would mean that we can interpret this. Remember, this is a source, or this is a reason why when you learn scattering amplitudes in quantum field theory, everybody uses the convention that all particles are incoming. You'd say, well, isn't that such a silly thing? Or all particles are outgoing. And the reason is that even crossing, there is really no distinction between saying particles 1 and 2 are incoming and 3 and 4 are outgoing. So you can just choose any particles you want. So you choose all particles to be incoming, and then you put a plus sign here. Well, if that's true, then that imposes a consistency condition on this amplitude. It means that this, as a function of S and T, we have to be the same as a function of T and S, because there is really no distinction. Okay? So that's the condition of crossing. So let's write it here. So this would imply that our function, we have to satisfy this condition. Isn't this a nightmare? How can this possibly be something that satisfies that condition? We're saying that in the S channel, it looks like this. Well, in field theory, you have the same problem, except that when you're just doing QED, you have exactly the same problem. The only difference is that you have only one diagram, say, something like this. And this one contributes some T over S minus M, say. Let's even say that you have a scalar propagating here. So you have something like this. Well, the way you build a function that satisfies crossing is by saying that in field theory, you also have to allow other diagrams. You also have to allow this diagram. You add the two, and this is your amplitude. Now, this is just the simplest way to make something that is symmetric in S and T. Okay? Well, if we did the same thing here, of course we will get something that is symmetric in S and T, but that's not very satisfying because we got this problem here, now we will get something even worse. Okay? So we're just doubling the amount of trouble if we're going to look at loops. Now, somebody came with a brilliant idea, which is that if this is an infinite series, if this series truncates at some point, we are doomed. There is no way you can have something that is symmetric in S and T unless you symmetrize explicitly. Okay? And what is the reason? If this series is finite, there is no way you can develop poles in the T channel by summing, by having just a polynomial in T. But if this is an infinite series, okay? Just imagine you have this series. Is there any way this series can have a pole? Where is the pole of that function? Excellent. Yeah, this function actually has a pole because it's nothing but this guy. So it has a pole at x equals 1. So somebody said, well, maybe if you can adjust these coefficients correctly, this function could be made to have poles exactly where the other guy, if you flip S and T, will have poles. Okay? Of course, that's a very long shot. I mean, how can you imagine? These masses are supposed to be precisely the masses we were talking about. They are related to the spin in a particular way. So the existence of these coefficients is far from guaranteed. But Veneziano decided to give it a shot and try and find something that would do exactly what I said. You will have a function whose coefficients are such that this will develop poles everywhere in the t-channel when t happens to be equal to some mj squared. Okay? So how would you go ahead and try to build that function? You know it has to be symmetric in S and T. Well, the answer to actually doing this systematically is that there is no way to do it systematically. You just have to be a genius and come up with the answer from the start, and then you prove that it satisfies the correct properties. So it's good that there are geniuses, and then they come up with the right answer. Okay? Well, I guess maybe he was, I don't know, going in Wikipedia and learning about new functions and so on. And then he came across the gamma function and said, oh, look at that. The gamma function has tons of poles. And then maybe if I do something interesting, something will happen. So he came up with this formula where the gamma function is something that looks like this. Okay. Well, it turns out that this formula does exactly what you need. Okay? It's symmetric in S and T. If you expand this for as a power expansion in S, in order to see how it looks like, or if you do it in as a power expansion in T, you will find precisely that each term in that is a function of S has the correct poles, and you will find some numbers here. So that's the way you will find the numbers. You just come out with the answer, expand, and then find the numbers so that it works. Okay? So that looks great. Now, of course, he found that everything works out. There is a single constant here. This is alpha prime. Remember, this was the constant of proportionality. So that even works. Everything works out with this definition. Now the question is, well, you have that object. That seems to be the answer. The question is, what happens at large momentum? Well, when you put them in loops, is there something interesting that will happen with this function? Well, it turns out that this function, when t goes to infinity and s goes to infinity, keeping the ratio fixed, okay, goes as a function of the scattering amplitude, of the scattering angle to the to this power. But remember, this was a positive number, okay? Well, I didn't tell you, but this was, well, it has to be a positive number because this is m squared. So this is a positive number. So this thing actually decays exponentially. So that sounds great. So adding up a bunch of guys that are blowing up like crazy, when you put them in loops, you actually get something that decays exponentially, and it couldn't behave better at infinity. Okay? So this was actually so good that it was wrong, sadly.
F of what?
Yes, f of theta, which is the scattering angle. Yeah, so well, but at the time, they didn't know that this was wrong, that this was too good to be true, literally. Okay. So people got very excited and decided to search for what theory. This is not a theory, right? This is just the answer. So if you want to explain this to your friends who are not geniuses, like me, so you have to come up with a theory that produces that. Well, people realize that this behavior and this could actually be obtained, and actually the symmetry between S and T could actually be obtained by a model that uses strings as the objects that are interacting. But let me say something else. This you might hear at some points that these models were called dual models. Okay? And the reason for calling these dual models is the following. That if we call this A of ST that we got in the S channel, remember, the sum over TJ's S minus M squared J's. Okay, let's call this. And let's call AT ST. The other one. In field theory, you would add the two, right? But Veneziano's hypothesis was that the dual hypothesis was that A of S, A sub S, S of T, is equal to AT S of T. Okay? So this is the dual hypothesis. That this object happens to be its own T-channel formula, okay? Happens to be equal to the other one. So models that would reproduce this were called dual models, and later on they were realized to be actually models where you have strings. And the reason, the picture that explains this duality is the following. If you imagine you have a string, so the incoming particle, one of the incoming particles, P1, is a string, comes and interacts with another particle, P2. They form a string that evolves and then splits into two. Okay. Now, from this picture, it's impossible to tell which one is the S and which one is the T channel. So just by using this model that you have the strings evolving in time, so now here we want to imagine this as strings evolving in time, joining and splitting. So this is a picture in time, okay? So at a given time, we'll just see the two strings. So the two strings are coming, forming a single string and then splitting. Of course, in quantum field theory, that's not really the way we compute it. I mean, that's not really the interpretation, but in any case, so this picture is an intuitive picture for why, if you try to do this computation using strings, you would expect to get an answer that is symmetric. Okay, very good. But then people were faced with the problem of having to quantize or having to come out with a theory of strings that actually makes sense quantum mechanically. Okay? Well, the price was very high, right? If you could do that, you would explain all strong interactions. So there was a good motivation to try, and people did try, to make a theory of interacting states. So they were looking for a quantum mechanical theory of relativistic strings. Okay?
Sorry, I have a question. Where did those strings appear? Like, how is this a string model? Like, how do I know by looking at this model, if you hadn't drawn the picture, that there are strings there?
Which picture? This picture? No.
Well, without the picture. Yeah.
Without the picture, how would you have? Well, yeah. I think it took like three more geniuses to actually come up with the string picture. Yeah, I don't think it's obvious. No. Well, it came from the relation of the mass square being proportional to the spin. Because in fact, nowadays we know in QCD you expect that relation to come out from a flux tube that forms, right? So the higher the spin, the higher the mass, because the flux tube grows, right? So that idea that there might be some string comes from that relation. But from there to actually developing the theory and computing this amplitude and getting that answer actually took several of them. Okay? So it's good. Don't feel like you have to like it was obvious that from here you had to get a string theory. So if we depending on time, we will see, of course not today, but maybe at the end of the week, we will try to do this computation and see how that formula comes from the theory. Okay? But let's continue here and say, well, this is now what you have to do, like a very responsible person. You propose your theory. Now you try to do everything by the book, which means you have to quantize it and see what happens. Now there were two problems. Problem one, quantizing a string is not as easy as quantizing a point-like particle. Quantizing a point-like particle happens to make sense, or at least we can follow the rules in any number of dimensions and nothing happens. You can just quantize a theory of particles in any number of dimensions and nothing really happens. Well, except that, well, it depends. It might be that the theory is not renormalizable, so it doesn't make sense, but it's not like you couldn't. It doesn't make sense because it loses predictive power. You could renormalize, you can make the theory by adding an infinite number of contour terms. You can always make sense of the theory somehow, right? But there is nothing that stops you from quantizing a point-like particle in any number of dimensions. That's not true for the strings. Actually, as we will see, the strings impose a condition on the number of space-time dimensions, and the number that it chooses, or the condition, comes from some crazy quantum mechanical condition that is called an anomaly. And that condition could have very well told you that the number of space-time dimensions was some random pi over the square root of 2. Then you will be completely dead. It would mean that the strings could not possibly be consistent with some description of space-time. Okay? But strings were kind enough so that When you just use the rules of quantum mechanics, they tell you that the theory is anomaly-free if you just have strings that only carry bosonic excitations in 25 plus 1 dimensions. Okay? Well, you would say, oh, that sounds crazy. But it sounds bad because we don't live in 25 plus 1 dimensions. But if you think that, as we will see, this quantum mechanical anomaly is just some crazy computation, and the requirement that it cancels had no reason to be an integer number, then you say, well, maybe 25 plus 1 is not that bad. It could have been e to the pi. So this is really not that terrible. Say, well, okay, maybe we don't understand the theory, people thought. But there was another terrible problem. And this was really bad, and people didn't know what to do. You would say, when you have strings, say, well, OK, the strings will only describe massive particles, right? Because the string has some tension, so that's very good. But when you quantize, there is something called the Casimir effect, the zero-point energy, that actually pushes the spectrum down. Then there is something very bad that happens. These theories that were supposed to describe these strong interacting particles, which were an infinite tower of massive particles, and only massive particles. Remember, we don't like massless particles. We're in the 60s or in the 70s, right? Now the zero-point energy pushes the guys down, and all of a sudden you get massless particles. How annoying is that? Now, not only that, you get massless particles, some massless particles. You will get an infinite tower of massive particles as well, which is what you want. But you also get massless particles. And no matter what you try, no matter how you modify the theory by adding things, removing things, there is always an annoying particle there, which is a particle that is a or that corresponds in a space-time to something that would come from a traceless symmetric rank 2 tensor. Now, in any number of dimensions, this would be it. But if you go to four dimensions, okay, this would be precisely what describes something that has helicity, a massless particle with helicity plus or minus 2. So there was no way to get rid of this thing. Anything that you could do to the theory would produce this guy there. People try very hard to get rid of this because this was not in the Strong's interactions. Okay? Yes? Yes, but remember, we're not trying to describe gravity. We're in the 70s and trying to describe strong interactions. So this is a terrible problem. Okay. Of course, then you say, well, maybe we have to live with this thing, and let's continue. Well, but things got really, really bad when the very, very good behavior of the Veneziano amplitude was too good to be true. So what do I mean by that? So in the 70s, there were experiments, and it was discovered that in the strong interaction, the scattering had a power law decay. Remember, we said that for very, very high momentum, we found that the Veneziano had an exponential decay. Well, experiments are telling us that the actual strong interactions has only power law decay, not exponential. So, and this power law decay, probably Michael Peskin gave you a whole lecture about this, is precisely what tells you that inside hadrons, that they actually look like a bag with point-like particles. At least when they scatter a very, very high momentum. Okay? Now, too bad. Now it's a complete disaster. Experiments are telling you that really, inside these guys, there are point-like particles, not the strings. Okay? So, well, you think strings are dead because they don't describe the strong interactions. But then somebody said precisely what you said. Said, well, but wait a minute. Well, if this guy is definitely not the theory of Strong's interactions, well, at least he has something that looks like the graviton. Could it be a theory of gravity? Moreover, some people say, and actually John Schwarz says that, because he's one of the guys who tried to kill this particle very hard and couldn't, says, well, if you have a theory and you try to kill something from the theory and the theory doesn't allow you to do it, then whatever you get there might be called a prediction of the theory. Actually, it's completely unbiased because it was something that you didn't like, and the theory was giving it to you, and there was no way to get rid of it. So he likes to say that, well, string theory at least was one prediction, which is that nature must have a graviton. Okay? But of course, just from what I told you, it's very cheap because all it tells is that there is a state. There are states that have that. Nowhere have I told you or have I given you enough tools or even told you that these particles interact the way we want them to interact so that they can be called gravitons. Okay? So at the moment, we don't take that very seriously. And we continue here. But before we continue here, now you know that something else must happen. You need another theory to describe this. It's not strings. There must be something else. So if there has to be something else, you might say, well, this is really bad. We have to start from scratch, okay? Already in the 70s, we have to build another theory from scratch. But there is something very interesting. In the 50s, way before anybody was thinking about these point-like particles there, Young and Mills were doing something for fun. And literally, at the time, it was just for fun, right? They said, well, if Maxwell theory is based on a U1 gauge, on a U1 group, well, they first realized that Maxwell theory was actually a theory based on a group, which is U1, and that U1 is just the simplest of an infinite number of structures called D groups, okay? So U1 is just one in a family of Lie groups. And the simplest generalization of this one are called SUN groups. In fact, the one they studied was SU2, just when n is equal to 2. And they came up with a theory of interacting particles, of interacting spin 1 particles that would interact in such a way that there will be an SU2 gauge invariance. Okay? So Young and Mills came out with a theory of spin 1 interacting particles. Okay? Now, it so happens that, of course, here the U1, we know the photon was the only massless particles that we had. And it turns out that in order to have gauge invariance, they also had to have massless particles. It turns out that here you need 3 massless particles. You see how bold that was, right? At the time, everybody hated massless particles. Do you know why they hated massless particles? Do you know? In the 60s, why would they hate massless particles? Well, first, because there was only one, really, being observed. And second, because people were trying to build a theory of the scattering metrics just from analyticity properties. And if you assume that there is a massless particle in the game, basically, yeah, hell breaks loose. There are tons of infinities of very complicated analytic structures that happen to spoil everything that you know. So people really hated massless particles at the time because they will give you problems in the analytic structures of the S matrices. Now we understand what those problems are nowadays. Those are infrared divergences. At the time, they didn't understand them. But now we know what they are, and actually we like them. Well, not that way, but we know what they are, so that's good. Now that these guys were doing that at the time was very amazing. Okay, so this was just a theoretical idea. Now we know that that is precisely the theory that comes here. We know that if we take an SU3 Young-Mills theory, of course they deserve the name, we can build what we now call quantum chromodynamics, which is a theory that describes this. And of course, there was a problem. This guy has massless particles, so how come we don't see any other massless particles? But then the notion of asymptotic freedom was understood. And then that was the end of string theory, as a theory for the strong interactions, right? Because asymptotic freedom explains perfectly why we only see massive particles and why at very high energies these particles, these interactions are precisely governing what we see, okay? Moreover, now we know that the electroweak theory, which you're going to learn more about this week, and extensions of it, build together with QCD the standard model, which is now telling us that massless particles are actually great. Almost everything we know, well, actually everything we know for sure in the standard model is made out of massless particles. Okay, so now the whole thing ended up being the other way around. We don't know any massive particle. Our theories are telling us that everything are massless particles. Of course, the Higgs is the only candidate, but one has to see. Okay? Very good. So let's see. What time is it? Oh, it's time to stop. Well, let me stop by giving you some homework. Yeah, so let's see. So we got here. So next time we discuss this topic, we will go and discuss why we think string theory is actually a theory of quantum gravity. But in order to do that, I want you to do two things. So here is the homework. Yeah, I think this is 11 is right. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure which order I want them to. You will do both, right? So it doesn't matter which order I choose. So I want you to review. Well, since we're going to be doing quantum gravity, we're going to be doing, and we have to introduce, and we also have to explain many other things. So we have to start from somewhere. So I want you to review GR coupled to scalar field with a cosmological constant as well. Okay. So the action is, I know why. So the most general thing I can imagine is something like this. Okay? And this is in m dimensions. So I want you to, you guys are experts in GR now, right? So you have taken tons of courses, you know differential geometry, this and that, everything. So for you, it must be trivial now to take this action in m dimensions, assume this is generic, and compute the equations of motion, okay, the field equations for this theory, and try to study and try to review what the symmetries are, the global symmetries, and the invariances, okay? So global symmetries, and what are the invariances? Okay. And the second exercise is the following. I think you have seen SU3, right, as a gauge, as a group, or as a Lie algebra at some point. Probably you have seen the Gell-Mann matrices. Okay. These are 8 3x3 matrices. Okay. And you probably have noticed that Gell-Mann chose two of them to be special. He called them lambda 3 and lambda 8. Okay? If you haven't seen this, you can look at Peskin's book and find the matrices, or you can also search them in Wikipedia. They are also there. So you look for lambda 3 and lambda 8. These two guys are special, so your job is to understand why these two guys are special. Okay? And you will see that the other matrices have commutation relations with these guys, which are a mess in the way you will find them usually. Okay? So what I want you to do is to find combinations of the other matrices such that when you commute the other generators, let me call them lambda alpha, with lambda 3, okay, you get some number times lambda alpha. And when you do the same thing with lambda 8, you get some number times lambda alpha. In other words, I want you to find linear combinations of the other generators so that everything else are eigenvectors of lambda 3 and lambda 8. The precise meaning of an eigenvector will be defined later, but let me just say that this is what I want. Okay? So try to find linear combinations so that every other generator, the remaining 6, satisfy these relations. Okay? Okay. So we can stop here. Yes? A factor of 2, where? Here? Well, that's part of your job, to review everything about this. The factors, the pi's, the a pi's, g Newton, where should g Newton be, and everything. OK, any questions? No questions, and we can continue tomorrow.